Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong since 1982, and it's a Sunday night, and it's 8 p.m., so it's time for it to begin. As always, want to remind people of a few things. If you want to get in touch with me or have me get in touch with Paul, tap him on the shoulder, ask him to take a look at some NASA space-related thing and comment. Or if you have any puzzles or topics or questions that you just can't get to the radio to ask on the regular TechNet, we have an email address that you could reach me. It's mailbag@ac2gs.com. That's mailbag at, my call sign is alphacharlie2gulfsierra.com. Also, every week I put up a list of interesting links that I think people would like to peruse. The top few are not really, good for radios because there's some visual aspects to them, or they have to do with Paul's report. So I put those on top. And the second portion are topics that I might get to if we have time for the Science Talk segment this week. So please avail yourself of the link page. It is, again, roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room that's available for people to hang out and BS as the TechNet goes off. It's available either through going to Limark's own website and following the link there, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you right to the chat room. Also, want to remind people that if they have people that can't quite get to the radio or Echo Link or IRLP, I stream W2VL over the Internet. Try to make that 24/7 as much as I can. You can reach that by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the audio stream. And always want to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a wonderful archive of the technical nets that go all the way back to September 2006. Some of the brightest hams who become, unfortunately, silent keys through the year have left their mark on those archives with excellent advice that continues to be excellent. So please avail yourself of the wisdom of the ages on Mike's own archive site, which again is amateurradio.tv. Let me drop for a second and I'll tell you my plans for tonight. Okay, once again, in the fine tradition, I will ask people if they have any questions of a technical nature, and I will take names and call signs down, so you give me your first name and your call sign, and we'll try and get them in order. Around 8:30 or so, we will have another installment of Andy's Corner, and I'm particularly looking forward to this one. My understanding is that Andy's going to do a presentation on how he figures out how to repair broken equipment, which he has done for many, many years. And I've heard him tell the story over the phone, and I can't wait to hear it over the radio. It's a wonder to behold, so I'm looking forward to that. When he's done, I will return, finish up any unanswered questions or people on the list, open things up for any other scientific subjects, and if there's time, go into some of the Science Talk articles. Around 10:15, I will call upon Paul, WS2N, to bring us the SpaceNet report. That should take us to about 11 p.m., in which I will return once again, tie a bow on it, wish you well, and call it a week. So that's the game plan. I hope the repeater allows me to do that, and I thank the technical crew for hooking up links and such so that I can actually communicate with you. Here in the boondocks of Brooklyn, it's become problematic for a time, but hopefully that'll be repaired soon. So with that, let me drop and ask if anyone would like to put their name on the list for tonight.
KD2VHD, Jim, continuing my question from last week if I have a chance.
Certainly, Jim. It was 2 weeks ago. I missed you last week, but you're top on the list. Anyone else want to go on the list for tonight? First name and call sign, please.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. Just always wanted to be a benchman and fascinated with people who do that, so I'm just waiting for Andy to get going.
Okay, very good, Rich. I can tell that you're on your brand-new Anytone radio. My guess is you're in the medium power switch level.
That is correct.
Okay, very good. Once again, anyone else out there wants to have their name on the list for tonight? Any topics, any questions, what have you, just give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, I think it's just noise out there. Either someone's output is not getting through to the repeater, or else is just background noise. So let's take you, Jim. You're the first person on the list. What's your question for tonight?
KD2VHD. So I have a hypothetical antenna that I'm wanting to build. It's a little tricky. It's a little specialized, but it's... I imagine it's something that you folks would do. I'm going to let this drop and key up my power so I can get through clear. KD2B, HD back. So I'm looking to build a two-band NBIS antenna. And my research leads me to believe that I should be able to build an off-center-fed dipole, 25% on one side, 75% on the other. Mounted low, maybe 7 feet at the center, maybe 10, 11 at the end. Anybody had any experience with that type of antenna? And good luck or bad luck with such.
Okay, Jim. Jim has thrown out the question. I have not used off-center fed antennas. He's going to mount it low so that it's a near vertical incident sky wave. And I've read articles where that works. There's off-center dipoles that I think he's planning. There's things called Wyndhams, which is a little bit more problematic because the Wyndham design also includes part of the transmission line as part of the radiating element. And so by lowering it, you might have problems with that type of design. But just with a plane off-center, I don't see any particular problems. But Jim would like to hear from people who've had experience with off-center dipoles and especially near-vertical incidence versions of that. Well, gosh, the silence is deafening, guys. Doesn't anyone have any experience with near? I'm sure there are people out there with experience with near vertical incident skywave antennas of off-center design. So please, Jim would really appreciate an experienced person telling them their experiences. So if you're out there and you got a mic anywhere near you, try and use it and see what you can do. Participate. It's fun to participate in technical nets. Well, I don't know what to tell you, Jim. The crowd is somewhat silent tonight. Maybe it's a little too early. Maybe they need to kind of get comfy in their chair, in their shack or something. I don't know what the problem is. Often people love to discuss antennas, all different types of antennas. So I'm at a loss to explain why people who've had the off-center antennas aren't clamoring to give you their two cents worth.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
Just some hints. As soon as you start to move off center, the impedance goes up. So it would probably be very happy with maybe like a 450-ohm ladder line. And with an antenna tuner, it should be very happy. I see no reason why it's not going to work. Over.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Let me see if I have the repeater. Okay. I would agree with you, Ed. Usually the way dipoles work is their lowest impedance is at the center feed, roughly about 50 ohms. And as you move off center, it goes higher and higher. When you reach the end and you, for all intents and purposes, have an end-fed wire, you have an impedance of about 2,000 to 3,000 ohms. At around the point that the Jim is planning for his off-center dipole, it's probably about 200 or so ohms. Usually the design that everyone I've ever seen uses a 4-to-1 ballon to bring it back to 50, although you can run it with open wire for a way and then use a 4-to-1 ballon on the open wire to a coax that feeds into your house. But, you know, open off-centers have their benefit. They do a little bit better for multi-band operation than a strict dipole. And all dipoles tend to be better near vertical incident sky waves as you bring them closer to the ground, and the reflections off the ground produce a reinforcement going straight up, which is what you're looking for, because that's what the acronym near vertical incident sky wave means. It's that the RF is going close to straight up into the sky as opposed to at an angle off the 90 degree normal.
WA2CDL.
Yes, Andy.
Okay, good evening. Hope everybody had a nice day. As a repair technician, I always ask the very basic questions first, which everybody has not asked so far. So my question that I ask myself is, what is the purpose of having a near vertical incident antenna? In other words, the guy, and I forgot your name, the guy who asked this question, what is your application? What do you want to use this for?
This is Jim, KD2BHD. Excellent point. What I'm looking to do is do solid, reliable regional communications, let's say Long Island, tri-state area, with beyond, you know, infrastructure free, probably 40 meters during the day, 80 meters at night, or thereabouts, with other people, not DX capability, but regional communications. Does that answer what your question?
Yes and no. I don't understand why you have to have that kind of antenna for what you want to do. I operate on HF using a normal half-wave dipole, and I'm on 75 meters a lot. I normally don't have any issues. Unless you want to do it as an experiment. Now, that's another story. That's why I asked the question. So, you know, not to get into the whole topic of, you know, the reasons. It's just interesting that you asked that, because I have not. If I have in the past experimented with it, with this kind of antenna configuration, I would have jumped right in and I would have told you my experience. But because I don't have any experience in using this kind of antenna that's designed for near vertical incidents that would radiate upward, I mean, I never saw the need of having an antenna to do that in my application. So that's why I'm asking you the question.
I'll give a good example. I have a cousin on the other side of the island. Bald Hill lies between us. And HF frequencies don't seem to work because they're either going over each other or, with the near glint in the skywave, you can kind of jump over those things without repeaters, infrastructure free. So power outages, storms don't affect it at all. Lots of other things do. So it's actually the reason why I got my ticket. And so I'm new to this. My electronics knowledge is old. My communications knowledge is old. My ham license is brand new. But I got it for this specific reason. So that's why I'm heading in that path.
Okay, by the way, you say your name is Jim?
Yes, Jim.
Okay, very good. Good answer, too. I like that. And I don't want to take up a lot of time away from Roy, because I think there's other people that Roy didn't hear that checked in. There were some other people that Roy missed, so I'll let him check in. But I don't have any experience with that, so that's why I'm not going to, just make up something and say do this and do that. So that's being honest, that I didn't have the need for that. I don't know how well it's going to work, though. I'm not sure. If you know people who have used that type of antenna and were able to overcome the long path, because as you know and as you said, the band conditions go long and they go short, where I have the same problem. I can't hear stations that are here on Long Island, but I can reach out to Pennsylvania and upstate and beyond, and Vermont and New Hampshire without any trouble, but locally, no. So I don't know if that kind of antenna is for the application. I don't have the experience. I couldn't answer that. But I just thought I'd add my 2 cents. Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. And to be continued on that, Roy, back to you. I won't hold you up anymore. And there's other stations that checked in that you didn't hear. WHCDM.
Okay, very good. Let me see if I have the repeater. Okay. Andy, thank you very much. And, yeah, sometimes I, for some odd reason, this link that we have going through Plainview kind of misses people. If two people talk, it blanks both of them out, I guess. Well, but before you go for the moment, Andy, you yourself mentioned it. There's skip. When you're using the lower end of HF, very often there'll be these wide regions between ionospheric bounces where you won't get the transmission. So the whole concept between NVIS, which I think is very, very commonly used in the military because they have a lot greater need for using both HF, or at least in the old days, and getting local communications, is to adjust the takeoff angle so that it's a near vertical incidence, so that it bounces back on local areas, gets over little mountains, doesn't have skip. So most of us don't really think in terms of that because most of us are interested in DXing, and the last thing that we want is a near vertical incident skywave. We want a nice takeoff angle that's going to skip along the horizon and the ionosphere and go as far as it can possibly go. But I can understand why Jim might be more interested in local communications. And just by bringing any kind of a dipole down closer to the earth, you'll get, unfortunately, some coupling to the ground and the efficiencies will drop, but you'll change the takeoff angle to very close to straight up, which is kind of what Jim wants to do. So, again, I don't really have any experience with off-center dipoles, but near vertical incident skywave dipoles are just close to the ground. So it should work as far as the theory goes.
NY2H?
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, affirmative on the military. If they're in a mountainous region with a lot of valleys, et cetera, it works very well for them. I would wonder, I think, Jim, you'd have a greater chance of success, and I assume that this will be the situation, but that the person you're going to talk to, your relative or whatever, will also employ an NVIS antenna. that's probably, you know, what you're going to have to do. And then I think it should work. If he doesn't, well, then, you know, he could skip over you. So if you both do it, I think you got a good shot.
Agreed. That's my understanding also, and it improves the likelihood of success. Some interesting things that I've found out is that while a normal dipole, I believe in free air, theoretically has a impedance of 70 ohms, and that changes in real life. Off-center front dipole has a theoretical impedance of about 200 ohms, I think. But when you bring it down low to the ground, it brings it right close to 50. So there's some interesting interplays that I've learned. But what I get really lost on when I tried to make one hook up to an antenna analyzer, it's just the resonant frequencies just were not jiving. So I'm missing some part of the puzzle to make the thing work.
Yeah, let me see if I have it. Yeah, I don't know if it was John or whoever recommended the open line. That'll solve all your problems because you'll be able to tune it up without any loss. You see, when you have coax and you take it an off-resonant antenna and you try to tune it from the shack, the trips back and forth on the coax incur a lot of loss. But on open line, your loss is very low. So that's a good recommendation. If you feed that antenna with open line and then just match it in the shack, you should have no problem at all. You should get very good SWR and a good match.
I think that's probably a good technical solution, but I'll throw a couple curveballs at it. I'm looking to do this portable QRP. And trying to eliminate that loss of the vertical transmission radiation that's going to happen on that type of feed line. I can get it all going into the antenna. It'd probably take an un-un rather than a balun. So it's an interesting experiment.
Yeah, open line doesn't necessarily radiate. It's balanced. It should not radiate, actually.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
Years ago, we always used to feed them with a TV 300 ohm because we could find it on the ground and we couldn't afford coax. And we have homemade antenna tuners, and they work very well with windows over.
Well, you know, unfortunately, the time of TV wires that were 300 ohms are long gone from my experience. So, but there's a lot of open wire technology out there. There's something called the doublet, which is basically a non-resonant center-fed dipole. With if you feed it to open line, it has very low loss. Then the magic takes place at the antenna tuner. So, but if you position the dipole close to ground, you know you're not going to affect the takeoff angle by fiddling with the impedance. You'll affect it by changing its position to ground. So, as you mentioned, as you lower it down, the impedance drops, but that can be corrected. All these dipoles will actually work if you have the right antenna tuner. It could be off-center if that's your wish, or it could be a center-fed.
And to our VP question.
Yes, please.
I bought this N-Fed antenna. It's called the MFJ. It's called the 1982. It comes up to 200 watts. I didn't want to get anything with counterpoises. It says you don't need a counterpoise. I have an R7 W2ND. Works. He does. He sells some stuff at the flea market. He's one of my ham friends. So I'm gonna take the R7 down. It's not working, and I'm gonna put the N-Fed up. I get a dipole which works great. You know, I'm on HFNet every morning. Also,
I have a sports buying one. They said it's going to antenna analyze. Maybe that thing's not. Maybe it's the feed line isn't good. I don't know. But what you can get one for $200. I don't know what's a good brand. Is MFJ good? But my other my answer to my first question about the MFJ NFED, I don't think I need a counterpart, so that's why I bought that specific one.
Okay, we're still handling Jim's question. I thought you had a comment about that. If you'd like, I could put you on the list, and we'll do you next.
Sure, I'm welcome doing some computer work, so I'll be listening. Thanks.
Okay, so getting back to you, Jim, a lot of interesting information. You want to make it more portable, which is understandable. Antenna tuners do amazing things. They do better things if they're being fed by open line than coax, because a mismatch until you get to the antenna tuner is going to introduce a loss. But if you're operating this portably, you could wire the antenna tuner directly to the feed point, and then the transmission line is a meaningless concept. So that's another thing to keep in mind.
I had been thinking that very thought. That's definitely one of the possibilities. The other possibility is to just abandon the trying to have the antenna be automatically two-banded and make it a link dipole, and I can easily switch between bands that way. I'm heartened to know that my confusion is not, I'm not alone in my confusion. It's a dark concept, this what I'm trying to do.
Well, near vertical incidence is, as I mentioned earlier, more of a military thing than an amateur radio thing, although it's, I'm sure, in the questions for passing the exams and such. But most people are looking for a low takeoff angle, not a high takeoff angle. So I guess that's why a lot of people lack the kind of experience. But, you know, there's an infinite number of ways to skin a cat here. So a lot of different dipole designs, as long as you get them close to the ground, will give you that near vertical incident sky wave, and then it's just a matter of resonating. You could do a off-center fed, and off-center in the ratio that you gave gives you approximately a 200-ohm impedance in above the ground, a significant amount, a few wavelengths. As you pull it off center more, the impedance goes up and up and up. So it's a variable thing. Just by putting it off center to any ratio doesn't give you the same impedance. As you slide it from the center position to the end position, it goes from about 50 ohms to about 2 or 3,000 ohms. But there's a lot of different ways of implementing some form of dipole that's close to the ground that would suffice. You could even build a two-band fan dipole type of a thing, where you have two elements. One is tuned for one band, the other one is tuned for the other band. And when you select the band, you don't need a switch, because the impedance, since it's matched at resonance, will prefer that one. So there's a bunch of different ways.
Question also,
WHCDL. Yeah, Andy?
Okay, yeah, because I'm just curious about this, because, again, I have no experience with it, so I can't really add much. But, Jim, how much power, you said QRP, how much is QRP power? What is the actual power level of your QRP transmitter you're using, and how far apart? What is the range that you're trying to cover between you and your friend in distance-wise, and how many miles?
I'm planning on using a DX500 10-watt transceiver. Me and my friend are about 20 miles apart. I understand this mode is good up to a few hundred miles, 300, 400, 500 miles, something in that range.
Right, that's interesting. Okay. I wanted to ask you something else. I just forgot. All right, so yeah, because again, I have not done any research on it, so I don't know the specifications of an NBIS antenna. And so what you're saying is approximately 500 mile range. I guess that's over flat terrain also, because I know that I forget who just was talking about hills and valleys. Lou mentioned, I guess the military uses it in mountainous and valley areas. This would be over flat terrain, I'm assuming, is that right?
No, absolutely not. You can use this in the bottom of the Grand Canyon, in the bottom of a hole. It's doing the same thing, the repeater that we're using now. It just does it without any infrastructure. Bounces the waves off the ionosphere, but it's serving a very similar function to what we're doing right now.
Right, no, I meant with your location. Your location where you're going to install the antennas over flat terrain?
I'm going to put my antenna in my backpack. I actually have it, I'm building it on a kite reel, and ideally I'll be able to set it up in less than 5 minutes, the whole station.
Okay, that's very good. Yeah, quick deploy of an antenna. Okay, good. All right. I'll have to do some research on that myself, even though, you know, I just haven't done any because I didn't have the need to. But I just thought I'd interject that. All right, thanks, Jim, again. Roy, back to you. And I think there was another station that checked in that you missed.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy. Let me just shout out, if there's anyone, I have Matt, N2RBP, with a question. If I miss someone else, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign, please.
Bob, KD2UQK with a question.
This is KD2UDU Wayne. I also checked in, Roy, just to say... I'm waiting for Andy.
Okay, very good, Wayne. I'll put you down as waiting for Andy. UQK, Bob, and Matt I have on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight? Okay, well, we'll go maybe for one more question before we move on to Andy's Corner. I would like to build anticipation out there. Matt, did you want to re-ask that question that you came up with earlier?
Yeah, sure. I have a MFJ. It's an N-FET antenna. I bought it because I figured I'd have to counterpoise. It's called the MFJ. The 1982
something. I have to, you know, get. I want to grab that antenna. Hold on. KD2VHD. Roy, wait for him. I just wanted to thank everybody for their input. I'll continue to work on a project and try to share some info.
Okay, very good, Jim. I wish you luck, and please, when you have more information to share with us, we'd love to hear how it works out.
Quick question, Jim, where are you located?
I'm in Bayport on the South Shore.
Can you call again, please?
KD2VHD.
Okay,
then
move you up on
to
that. Thank you. The
police
is here.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
All right. I don't know if I heard this right, that Jim might deploy it with a kite. If so, just be careful of power lines and lightning.
Thank you, Jim. attaches on a kite reel. It just makes it very easy to pick up the wire and not kink it all up. It's just for handling the storage of the antenna.
Okay. As we used to say on the old show, never mind.
Jim, it's Andy again. Just give me a call one more time. I might have heard it wrong. Give me a call phonetically.
Oh, I'm still getting used to that. Kilo, Delta, 2, Victor, Hotel, David.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Hey, Schwab, you'll be back.
Okay, Matt, so you have an MFJ and Fed.
Okay, I'm looking at it in the bag. It's an MFJ 1982 MP 300-watt wire antenna. It's a NFED half-wave, goes from 80 to 10 meter. So I bought it because I don't do it. It says you don't need a counterpoise. So what I want to do is have my friend put it up. I got coax that going to the R7, but the R7 isn't working. I can't get it to work. But also, my other question is, I really should get an antenna analog. I won't use it that much, but I know it's a good one to get. Some guys recommended one. You can get it. MFJ makes them. I forget the brand. I think around $200. But those are my two questions. Back to you.
Okay, let's take them backwards, because I'm not quite sure what the first one ultimately is. Antenna analyzers. You know, some people love MFJ. MFJ fills a niche. They sell a broad spectrum of equipment at a cost-effective price point. Their quality assurance about 10 years ago was awful because they had the prison people putting things together. They've shifted out of prison labor into, I think, college kids and such, and so the quality is a bit better. I am not a terribly big fan for MFJ antenna analyzers. I have an Array Solutions antenna analyzer, which is very nice. It's a station design. You basically plug in the power, and you can plug it into a computer and run software. I have something from a company called Rig Expert. They make an incredibly multiple line of antenna analyzers. The price is based pretty much on the bandwidth that it's capable of measuring, so that an HF antenna analyzer goes for a lot less than one that will go all the way up to 1 gigahertz. Recently, we've talked a lot about a thing called NanoVNA. A NanoVNA is a little Chinese antenna analyzer, a VNA, that goes for $50 for the low end. There's a bigger screen, I think it's 5 inches, that goes for about $80-$85, and that's the one I have. It happens to have N connectors instead of SMA connectors. So I have three VNAs, none of which are MFJ, but I'm sure they're fine.
Yeah, that's the, I think that's one of the brands I saw at the ham radio outlet. Yeah, I have an MFJ tuner. I mean, I got this tuner in probably back in 94. Norm said, I mean, I bought it, and he set up my station and indoor antenna in my apartment. So I've had this tuner for many years. Maybe it was, I don't know if it was built by prison people at the time, but I was lucky that it worked. So, yeah, and then my other question, this is only right away the other question. I have an MFJ and antenna. I bought it because it states you don't need a counterpoise. So when I hook it up, I guess I just leave it outside. I have to put it in a box where it's water, you know, weatherproof. And do I put the box like up on like under the overhang at the back of the house, or does it go on the ground and then you bring the wire up?
Okay. Well, there's a problem with the concept of NFEDs. If you use an NFED at its resident length, so that it is a half-wave NFED, then theoretically you do not need a counterpoise. If you use it at any other frequency but odd multiples of half wavelengths, you need something as a counterpoise. And Mother Nature will fill in the details if it must. If you do not offer it a ground wire, if you do not offer it a basic counterpoise wire hooked up to the ground, it will simply take your transmission line and use it as your counterpoise all the way into your shack, which, depending upon how RF shielded your shack is not probably a great thing. So although they say you don't have to have one, it's certainly a good idea to have something that works like a counterpoise with an NFED, unless, of course, you're planning to use it purely as a resonant, a half-wave wire. Then you don't need a counterpoise. But any other frequency you choose will require one, and if you don't supply one, it will pour RF into your shack, most likely.
Okay, Roger. Yeah, I mean, it's a half-wave, 10 to 80 meters. So at 80, obviously, it will work good. It will be resonant. But I do have an antenna tuner, so I put it into the tuner. But I would definitely obviously ground. I'm going to ground it, of course. I'm not going to, of course, you want to do that. So maybe it'll be all right then.
Yeah, if you ground the balun, most of these things come with anything from a 9-to-1 to a 49-to-1 balun. And they include a ground connection. So if you're supplying a ground connection, surprise, surprise, you're basically giving it a counterpoise. So a rose is a rose is a rose. MFJ may want to call it something other than a counterpoise, but most of us think of it as a counterpoise. Like I said, half-wave resonant, no counterpoise needed. Anything off of that wonderful resonant frequency, you got to give them something. So a grounding wire will suffice. So it should work. I would raise the balun high because most of the radiation from the antenna is going to be close to the connection point. So you want the connection point to be high so that you don't have ground coupling and efficiency losses.
Roger, what I want to do is I'm going to put it, when we're ready to put it up, when that helps me, I want to put it like, I'll get like a plastic container, I'll seal it up in that because it's not to be weatherproof. And what I could do is, I'm on the second floor, so we can get a ladder, and what we could do is we could put it maybe several feet, maybe on the, actually even put it, what I could even do even better, if you want, on the roof of the house where I have my vertical, and I have my dipole, the one leg comes from up there. You can even keep it up there if you want on the roof, and it'll be like a slope, like not a, it won't be a, because it's an end fit, but it'll slope down, and it can have it go from to the roof all the way into the woods. I have an acre of property, I could do it that way, and then the coaxial jack, or I could put it underneath the eaves of the house, you know, like mounted that way. So, but when Matt has to help, we'll figure it out. And the antenna, I'd like to get one, you know, because when I do this project, you know, I like to make sure the coax I'm using it again, you know. I won't use that often, but you never know. Sometimes I have a mobile rig, HF, in the car, so you can use it for that. So I'll look at rig extra. I think I saw a ham radio outlet. What's that one called? Nano? That's a good price, $50. The Nano NVA?
Yeah, the product, it was designed, I believe, by a Japanese fellow engineer, and he then sent off the plans to China, and there's a whole bunch of different manufacturers. I would try and get mine through a legitimate distributor so that if you have any problems, you could send it back rather than buying it on eBay or, you know, some Chinese website. But it's called Nano VNA. They come in different models. There's version 1, which is the older one. There's version 2 that has a wider range of frequencies that it can work on. It comes in two different sizes, a small screen and a slightly larger screen. It's a touch screen. You use a regular pressure pencil to tap in your commands. It also comes with two types of inputs. Different models have two different types of inputs. The less expensive has SMA connectors, which are okay, but they're kind of flimsy. At least I found that they're kind of flimsy. I prefer the N connectors, and then you can put adapters on it and use it. Now, that's the lowest price point I could find. It's about $85-$90. But if you want to go Rig Expert, I have one of theirs. They're high quality. They're portable. They're sealed. They have replaceable batteries, which the NanoVNA doesn't. They have built-in batteries. But, you know, you have to decide on what bands you're interested in. And the lower the bands you're interested in, the less expensive those models are. They go by the designation of AA-. And then they give you the top of their frequency range. So AA50 would get you HF and only costs probably about $200 or $300, and it goes all the way up to AA1200 for 1.2 gigahertz and such. So you know, both of those you can't go wrong with a $50 VNA. I mean, it's a ridiculously low price for them, and they work. Companies wouldn't buy it for their engineers because they need better dynamic range and such, but it's a great bargain if you're interested in such things.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for answering my question. Thank you so much. This is N4BP.
W2BZ?
Yes, Rich.
There's also an AA0, which is software-driven, and about a year ago, they unlocked the software for it to go to 1.3 gigahertz. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Maybe you could correct me, Roy, but I knew it was just a circuit board one of their VNAs, and I bought it, and it's just been great. It is just a circuit board, and they did unlock it through software, and you can, I think it goes from, Roy, do you know the range of that one? Go ahead.
I'm not sure. I doubt that it goes to 1.3. I've had problems in that when I actually email them and ask them anything on this subject, I get no response, which is curious because if it's a commercial problem, if I have a problem with the Rig Expert, they usually respond overnight. I've sent them a few inquiries. It's one of those things that they apparently don't want to talk about. It's not really published anywhere. The problem with VNAs generally as a design is the reason why it costs more for higher frequency is not just a selling scam, but has to do with the linearity of the circuitry. It becomes increasingly less and less linear as you go up the spectrum. So it introduces error as you go up. How much error, I don't know, because they won't talk to me.
I think they don't want people to know that it's really one of their boards unlocked in software. I think they're very skittish about it. Maybe a hacker found out that he could do that and unlock it, and therefore sort of trash a couple of their other high-end models, but it does work pretty high. I forget, I haven't used it in over a year, but it goes pretty high now if you use it with their software.
Yeah, I realize that, and I've looked around, and they've twiddled with the software and done that. But the point, unfortunately, is that what would be really nice is if someone took a legitimately spec'd version of their, say, AA-1200 and ran the same test scans and showed back-to-back the two results, whether they were identical or significantly different. Without that, you can't really tell how accurate it is. You need a standard somehow.
That would do it, but what I found against, I think Andy was over here one night, and I think we tested it against his. I'm not sure, but I did test it against somebody else's DNA with the case around it and, you know, a whole different model number, and it gave just about the same reading. So whatever it's reading out, I'm pretty sure it's pretty accurate.
Okay. I mean, one of the problems is, if memory serves me, you have to tinker a little bit with it. You have to connect a UART to it so that you can get the signals coming in and out through the USB port. Whereas, you know, I don't know, I don't remember exactly how much it cost you, but like I said recently to Matt, a nano VNA you can probably pick up for $50. So I tend to doubt that your device was less than $50.
No, in fact, it was $100 when it first came out. And I haven't seen it drop at all in price. So
say again, I only got half of a call sign out of someone.
Alpha Charlie 2, Papa Lima.
Ah, Jeff, yes. What do you have to say, Jeff?
Hello, you're right. Yeah, I'm looking at it on DX Engineering for the Tesla board for $63 right now.
Oh, okay, thanks. You know, I mean, if you're a tinkerer and you're so inclined, then so be it. You know, I think it's at this point, it's reinventing the wheel. I mean, I realize that some people get a little bit itchy about Chinese stuff, but, you know, I've played around with my little nano VNA. It's a decent machine. And again, cost me about $80, and I didn't have to worry about a UART. I didn't have to worry about a case for it. It just, charge it up and it works. So, different strokes for different folks. That certainly is an option. And I thank Jeff and Rich for sharing that information with Matt. Okay, Bob, it's coming up to almost 9 o'clock. I think Andy would like to be released from his corner. Do you mind if we have Andy's corner first and then we come back to you for your question?
Sure thing, that's fine.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Bob. So it's 8:54, a wonderful time to introduce Andy and Andy's Corner. And I'm, you all should be looking forward to this. This is a special occasion. Andy has been repairing electronic equipment for almost his entire life. He was practically came out of the womb with a soldering iron, which probably hurt his mother a great deal if it was powered. I really look forward to him discussing the tricks of the trade there. So, Andy, WA2CDL, it's time for you to get out of your corner and into ours.
Let me see if I'm – okay, now I'm on the right frequency, yes. Okay, Lloyd, well, thank you. Yeah, I'm crawling out of my corner, folks. How are you? Well, antennas are not my forte. You can see that. Although I've put antennas together and I've used them, but I haven't really designed any antennas and played too much around with them, more so than playing around with taking things apart and figuring out how they work. I'm going to require, this is going to be a little bit of a different discussion tonight because I don't really have any material in front of me to read from. So this is all I guess, calling it ad lib. I'm going to, like, make things up as they go. But, of course, not really making things up, but, you know, talking about my experiences in repairing and how this all started. I request audience participation for this because if anybody has any questions or if anyone has something that needs to be repaired, let me see if I can guide you through that. Maybe you can do it yourself like I did, because nobody really trained me, per se. Nobody sat down next to me and showed me. I sort of figured it out. I learned how to read a schematic when I was in elementary school. And when I used to go into the library doing library hour, and instead of taking out novels and other, you know, normal books that most children read, I would go to the technical section, and I remember pulling out a book on transistors or something to that nature, and showing little circuits using the old 2N107 and 2N17 germanium transistors that were produced way back in the 50s, which I actually have in my possession, brand new, if anybody wants to see one. Okay, I think, Wesley, you want to see what a 2N170 looks like?
No, I remember that stuff. I wanted to see if you worked. I was listening to you for quite a time. And I do want really to express my great appreciation for your work and for your knowledge. And I believe that you went very high up. And I'm very much happy that you are with us. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Wesley. I try to help. And of course, you know, part of what I do is the tune-up tables at different flea markets. And if somebody has a problem, you know, I could check out the radio with no cost. You know, there's no charge. But you'd be surprised. I've been active on 75 meters, and you talk about technical people. There's some really knowledgeable people out there that have designed some really interesting circuits, and they talk about that, what they've done on the different frequencies on 75 meter AM. These are AMers, and they operate their boat anchor rigs and also, you know, build their own equipment. And there's a few guys in particular that are very knowledgeable in this field. But all right, so, you know, getting back to me, I basically started repairing CB radios when I was a CB before I was an amateur radio operator. Now, of course, I just said a bad word, CB, but believe it or not, you know, CB is a great band. I'm talking about the 11 meter band for a citizens band, you know, citizens radio service, and I did have a license for it. And when I got my first Lafayette CB radio, I was thrilled. A little six-tube radio that puts out about 2.5 or 3 watts or so. And it really opened up the door because I was interested in you know, how it worked. And then I started collecting some CBs. I pulled them apart and looked over the circuitry where you can actually see the components as compared to now. and my own curiosity enabled me to sort of study some books that I had, some technical books, and learn about the transmitter and receiver and so on. And it actually catapulted me in taking my amateur radio exam, which I got my general, and you know, take the test and then get my ham license. You know, so I'm just giving you a basic overview of how this whole thing started. There's many aspects to, you know, getting into a repair. And if I get the words wrong, I'm just, as I say, I'm making this up as I go along. So just, you know, bear with me. And if anybody has, again, any questions or if...